Welcome to the New York Times podcast. You are 10 years and 30 minutes of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. Often I say I want art money. It's true. That's J. Paul. And you're probably in one of two camps right now. You are probably extraordinarily excited to hear a J. Paul record, certainly in the year of our Lord 2023. Or maybe you are younger and thinking, what is this obscure artist? I learned something this week, which is that the J. Paul demographic definitely skews a little bit older and it cleaves pretty cleanly. It tells me what generation of internet obsession you belong to, your relationship to J. Paul. So we are going to talk about J. Paul this week, not because there's no music, because obviously there's not any new music, but because J. Paul has emerged from the shadows and performed a few shows recently. He played at Coachella both weekends, unlike Frank Ocean, and he played two shows in New York. I went the first night on Tuesday at Knockdown Center. Lindsay Zolaz, who is here, went Brooklyn Steel on Wednesday. We probably should have done what we did for Harry Styles, to be honest.
Yeah.
I can't believe we didn't think of that first. We should have thought of that before. So we are going to talk today about the J. Paul phenomenon, the backstory, and of course, what it was like to be in the room watching, frankly, a seemingly very uncomfortable man perform undeniable music. Later in the show, Gia Tolentino, who was also there on Tuesday, Gia is going to come through and chat a little bit about the mystique of J. Paul. And before we get into it, I do want to say there are some t-shirts left. I'm sort of assuming most people want a t-shirt, have a t-shirt by now. But if you don't, we have t-shirts left, but we now have stickers. There are Popcast stickers. So if you very simply want to put a Popcast sticker on your dirt bike, if you want to put it on your laptop, if you want to be like one of those folks who puts a Supreme sticker like on the bumper of their car, sort of like a bumper sticker, but it's a Supreme BOGO sticker. If you want to be like that, but for Popcast, boy, do I have great news for you. It's the popcast.myshopify.com. We have stickers. They're very beautiful. They are also in the Cameron Purple Haze font because I commit to the bit. So knock yourselves out. Come buy them. I will personally put them in an envelope for you. I will peel the thing. I'll close it up. And I bought a little stamp with the return address so I don't have to handwrite the return address hundreds of times. So anyway, if that's an exciting thing, it's the popcast.myshopify.com. And I will see you guys at the U.S. Postal Service post office. Okay, but enough of business. Because you know who also is not that into business is J. Paul. J. Paul, not terribly into business, unless it's property week real estate. Lindsay.
Who made the merch, though?
Who made the merch? So there has been a string of J. Paul merch over the years, he's probably released more merch than music, if we're going to keep it a buck. 2013, the leak of the demos, I know was meaningful to both you and I in a very intense way, which probably just indicates how old we are. Before we get into the shows, can you tell me what the internet was like in 2013?
Can I ever? Peak Tumblr era, we're going to say?
Different Tumblr. I feel like my peak was maybe a little bit earlier than that, but yeah, certainly. active Tumblr era.
Sure. Strange times. Looking at 2013 as the moment that we're going to. I think two important things we have to preface this with are he essentially releases at this point one song a year. BTS2U, his debut single, sort of just a demo found on MySpace.
That's the sort of the apocrypha.
Yes. Releases a second song. Again, release is a very questionable term with any J. Paul music. Exactly a year later in 2012. And then a year after that, we get this leak of what seems to be a full album posted onto Bandcamp very mysteriously for £7 to download.
I had forgotten that detail. I revisited your piece.
I also needed a refresher because 2013.
A lot of lifetimes.
Many internet years
ago. And we should say, before we talk about the leak itself, it's not simply that he released two songs and then had an album leak and then people liked the album. These songs felt, dare I say, generational. Like, in terms of the texture, the songwriting, the influences, it was a moment where what we now think of as kind of like independent or like artful R&B was starting to like come into focus. The broken version of dance music was kind of a little bit in vogue. There was also the sonic quality. These are not kind of like polished or sealed up recordings in any way. They felt purposefully broken. The fact that they were demos almost makes me too scared to ask, like, bro, did you mean to polish this? Because, like, I don't want to know. I'd rather not know if he wanted to do that.
Yeah, and the unpolished quality of the production was part of the charm. There's a lot of really cool ideas going on in the production of even just these first two songs. There's just moments that cut out where it almost feels like a weird DJ set, but there's something really internal and kind of personal about them too. And there's an introverted quality to all J-Paul music that, as having seen him live now, may not be entirely coincidental. But there really were a lot of ideas on those tracks. Even just thinking about someone releasing one song a year, that speaks to something about the relative speed with which the internet and like social communities moved in 2011 and 2012, that was enough to keep this fan base curious and feeling like, are we going to get something next April from J-Paul? Like, I don't know that works that way in the age of the data dump mixtape and just, you know, putting every demo out there. There was something about the scarcity of this music even before the leak comes. You know, he seemed like someone who knew how to use negative space really well, both on the tracks and in the production, but also in the sort of endless chatter.
Like the public anti-presentation.
There was a lot of just extra stuff out there, you know, on the internet, more so even now, but even there was this feeling, you know, of this first or second wave of social media that he's emerging from, that there just was a lot of detritus out there and a lot of people throwing whatever at the wall to see what stuck. And it felt like there was something purposeful in what J-Paul was doing and what he was holding back at that specific moment from 2011 to 2013, which is kind of the J-Paul era in a way. There were so many things out there that if you knew the right amount to hold back and the right amount of mystery to sort of cultivate around your music, that was currency. And that was something that was going to get you noticed in some way. And
which, of course, counterintuitive to be like obscure as a thing of getting noticed. But this is also, it's important to remember, this is also the same time period of The Weeknd.
Yeah. House of Balloons is what, 2011 as well?
2011. We're at a moment in the internet at that point. You know, we're not really at a Spotify moment. There are cracks. Things exist in these kind of like liminal and marginal spaces. And there is that sense like, huh, I truly discovered this. Like, or the pachinko board that led to this thing being on my computer are unique to me in some way, which I do think goes a long way to explain the fervor of this J-Paul thing. The fact that there are people who were there at the shows this week, like I've been like holding their breath for a decade.
There was almost a like tape trading quality to sending, you know, links of those first two singles. Like I remember with BTS to You, a friend sent me the link via GChat and was like, you got to hear this. And I was like, what is this? This is so weird. I love it, but I don't really understand. You know, at a time when the mainstream pop world was, as ever, taking up a lot of space, there was this underground internet quality to the J-Paul experience that, you know, I think people were were craving some of that. And there was a secret handshake, like if you know, you know quality, that has sort of retained its sensibility like into these shows.
And I think if the same two songs had, or two songs with the same rough profile and attention had come out in like 2015, I don't know if the fervor would have been quite the same, because I do think you, like what we're dealing with is the residue. I think the tape training analogy is great. You're acquiring these things on an individual micro level. It's not being jammed down your throat. It's not being like vomited at you by the internet. The internet is still a little bit like rough brush, and you like sort of like hack your way through it and be like, I found this thing. This is a good moment. We should listen to Jasmine, because we haven't listened to Jasmine. Jasmine is the second J. Paul single. And at this point, after Jasmine comes out, my guy's two for two. He's batting 1,000. Absolutely. So this is Jasmine. Lindsay, yeah. Where were you when the J. Paul demos leaked? When you found out?
I was where everyone was. I was on the internet. I was on my computer. I think I actually was in the Pitchfork office, which was really the epicenter.
Actually.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because this was the time that I was working on staff there. And it was like a moment. We had like a meeting about, do we review this or not? Like, is it ethical to review this? And we came down initially on no. Like, I wrote an essay about it that was more like, let's tackle this as kind of a cultural artifact. But there was this sense of fragility around Jay that obviously has not abated either, but that really, like, those were the conversations we were having after this leak of like, are we making it worse by even like listening to this music, even though it's so good? And the leak comes out, like someone posts it on what looks like an official Bandcamp page. I don't know how many times it's downloaded, but it's downloaded enough before it's taken down to really be passed around on
file sharing services.
Files and, yeah. You know, like if
rapid
you
shares,
wanted it, yeah. You could find a way, which again, also kind of adds to that tape trading thing. Like it was not, you had to know someone who knew a link to get the zip. And there was that element of excitement too. But at the same time, like I think J. Paul created a Twitter account to basically say, hey guys, this material leaked. Please don't buy it. There was this element too of someone was making money off of this download. We should mention too, there's always the accompanying skeptics being like, was this all orchestrated by the label? Or did Jay do this himself? And they're trying to cultivate this image of this fragile genius who doesn't want you to perceive his work, and that's only making people freak out more about it. I don't really think so.
I don't think so.
I think that once this narrative took off and once the music was out there, I don't think it was bad for business necessarily. It's only added to the mystique.
If
in a
you
certain
wish
way,
to but... do business, that is.
Yeah,
this is not a person who seems terribly inclined to do business, which is why, yeah. Like, when I think of the potential narrative that this is something that he orchestrated or da da da. No, because if that was the case, there would have been another shoe that dropped.
Yeah.
There would have been something that dropped, like whether a finished version of the album or a tour or even an interview of some kind. J. Paul has never done an interview outside of a brief conversation with Dazed magazine in 2011. Jay, call us. Paul, come on Popcast. Lindsay and I will talk to you. You can tell us what you think of what we think of your music.
Yes.
So let's talk briefly about these songs, because they did eventually get released in 2019. I want to say, obviously, there's some part of me that's like, oh, this is magical. It's like everything's mystical. It's ghost-like. It's you never know when it's going to pop up. And then there's like another part of me that's like, this is hubristic as this is crazy 6 years later to be like, I'm just going to drop this thing on you and assume people will care. And then 4 years after that to be like, I'm going to play six shows and assume people will care. But much like you and I live in the internet of the early 2010s, it's very clear to me that Jay Paul also lives in the internet of the early 2010s. So
yeah, that's part of the nostalgia factor too, of like to go to these shows in some ways was going back in time. Like,
yeah,
to a simpler time that we thought at the time was not simple at all, but like compared to where we are now.
No, it's like the 1930s.
Yeah.
One of my favorite songs on the album, and I was glad that he played it, was Zion Wolf Theme. And if you look at Spotify in the 2019 version of this, and the album is called Leak 0413, which is when the album leaked, Bait Ones, which I don't know what that means. Almost all the songs are song title / unfinished, except for the Jasmine and BTS to You, which are / demo. Let's listen to Zion Wolf Theme.
Are you familiar with the parable of the boiled frog?
I'm Ested Herndon, the host of The Run-Up from The New York Times.
I believe so, but I would need to remind you.
Give it to us.
For 6 years, I've had a hard time getting establishment Republicans to say publicly what they've all said privately about Donald Trump. Then, the midterms happened.
So you can put a frog in boiling water and it'll jump out, right? But if you put a frog in a pot of water and then turn up the heat, he'll eventually cook to death without jumping out, right? So we became that frog.
For the past few months, we've been reporting from inside the political establishment as they try to figure out their path forward behind closed doors. This season, we go behind those doors. You can find new episodes of The Run-Up on Thursdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's say you're a writer, right? You work on pieces. And let's say someone somehow managed to get a piece of yours that was 70% done, charitably, 75% done, and shared it on the internet under your name, effectively. And people were like, this is incredible. This Lindsay Zolad's, can you effing believe that this Lindsay Zolad's piece is this incredible? And you know, it's not finished. Are you feeling, on the one hand, damn, if I finished this, it would be 2x incredible, 3x, like they don't even know what incredible is? Or do you think, maybe I don't know what incredible is because all these people seem to think that an incomplete version of a thing from me is A++. And maybe, hi, I'm the problem. It's me.
I'm always inclined more towards the like personal existential crisis part of it. So I think I'm in the latter camp there.
I feel like I'm in the former.
Well, see, this is why we're on a podcast together.
That's correct. That's accurate. If you extend that sort of like philosophical question a little bit broader, what does it mean for a thing to be complete? And we're living in like a moment of heavy memification, artificial intelligence songs, like no thing is ever finished at this point. Things are constantly subjected to edits and rewrites and expansions and reinterpretations. But here is a thing that there are two distinct marks. The musician thinks it's not finished, but every single person who's listening to it doesn't care because it's the only version that's available. Who wins? Who wins there?
I mean, I guess the public and the listeners. And I think almost any other musician almost would just go with it and say, like, you know what? This is being reviewed rapturously. I have found like a fan base for this piece of art that I obviously care really deeply and personally about. It's out there now. People are embracing it. This is what it is. On to the next. And that is not how J. Paul reacted, which again, I think sort of makes him this outlier, both like in the music industry at large and in the moment that he's working in, which, you know, again, I brought up the data dump era and the mixtape era and like looking at other artists around him. And I think The Weeknd is a really interesting counterexample. House of Balloons and J. Jasmine or BTS to you were talked about in the same breath, like when they came, like that's of the same moment to me. And if you told me like one of those guys was going to like headline the Super Bowl halftime show by himself and have like one of the most long running chart hit singles of all time in 2011, I would have been like, neither of these guys are like, this music's too weird. So there was like a pathway to go from this kind of weirdo underground alt pop stuff right up to the mainstream. And I think
J-Paul call Max Martin challenge.
No, don't.
Very simply, all I have to say is you're welcome.
I just did the kombucha girl meme like in real time there. I was like, no, maybe. I mean, I just don't think it's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen, but like, wouldn't it be something?
I think two people that are really interesting, two contemporaries of his to think about are The Weeknd and Frank Ocean, who is once again, for very different reasons, being mentioned in the same breath as Jay. Even Frank, for as slow the trickle of music, or not even, has been from him, there is this sense that more people know who Frank Ocean is than Jay Paul. Even
I just
want
to say, Jay Paul has released music more recently than Frank Ocean has.
Whoa. Yeah, you're right. Wow. And performed more weeks at past Coachella.
He also, as a thought exercise, on weekend one, did Jay Paul attend the Frank Ocean set? And if so, was he taking notes? Or was he like, damn, bro, really? Like, you missed big and you still doing what I'm doing? What was he saying? Just you know, thought exercise. We should talk about the shows, obviously. So yeah, 2 weeks. Yeah. So when they announced the Coachella lineup in January, like, you see Frank Ocean at the top and you're just like, wow, he's really going to do it. He's really going to play Coachella. That was not my moment. My moment was looking at like line three and being like, is this a typo? Like, is there some other Jay Paul that's playing Coachella? Like, that was way more of an explosive thing to me as a fan and as a critic. Videos from the first weekend, I would say, were not promising. He started late, the live stream, he was like going to do it, and then they took it off, and then they like tacked it on the end in the middle of the night. Some catching like little bits and pieces, I would say, was not promising. The second weekend videos seemed a little more promising, but this did not appear to be an individual thrilled to be on stage in front of people who love him. You didn't get that vibe.
No.
But, you know, Coachella, it's awkward. Obviously, it's great to look out and see 10, 20, 30,000 people like looking back at you, but it's not your crowd. You know what I mean? It's not the same as like we're in a room together, people who like paid whatever they paid specifically to come and see me.
Yeah,
that's a different thing.
And I trust that anything extraordinary that happens, I will be able to see in some other way from the comfort of my own home.
Yes.
At this point, like,
not, you know, untrue.
We have beautiful documentation of Beyonce's set, and I knew that nothing like that was going to happen this week or this year. So, you know.
So there's two shows. There's two more shows in London, and maybe 45 shows that they haven't announced yet. I don't know, but there's two shows. My first vibe walking in on Tuesday night was, this is a slightly older crowd. This is a crowd. These people have jobs. Number one, these are employed people. Like, the last time I went to Knockdown Center was for Drain Gang, and I was like, these people are not employed. Whereas with this show, I was like, everybody here has a job. Like, everybody is like a associate creative director of something. People are very excited. It only started 30 minutes after it was intended to start, which is fine. Totally within the margin of error. Not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
The rapturousness of the reception was not at all in line with like what was coming off the stage. Now, I didn't by any means have like a bad time. I like these records. I thought the second half of the show, which like leaned more on the hits and like the sort of more tempo driven records, were mm-hmm. was better than the first half of the show, which felt a little like maybe too vibey for someone who like has no public facing presence and doesn't seem terribly inclined to take his sunglasses off on stage. Like, maybe you want to open with BTS to you. You know, like, maybe you want to open with Jasmine.
Yeah,
you might want to let people know I'm this guy. Like, you might want to do that. But I probably would have been just as happy if he came out, like, sat on a chair, pressed play on some songs, and just kind of, like, waved at folks. He sounded good. Like, you know, when he's singing, some of these songs don't require loads of singing. That's the other thing that I hadn't consciously thought of before walking in, but like watching him up close, I'm like, huh, in some of these songs, you're just you're showing up every 20 seconds to do like a little like a mule or a yelp or a howl or whatever. They're not like all written through singing songs. Like, it was fine. It just seemed like everybody was just like deeply like, it was fine.
It was fine.
Not a critic's pick.
My most pleasant surprise, and again, we went to different shows, and we went to
different venues
with different quality sound systems.
Like, yo, Knockdown Center. Like, I love the basement. I love how loud it is in the basement. I love getting assaulted by the speakers in the basement, but the main space, yeah, y'all got to work on that.
I was pleasantly surprised by how good his voice sounded. You said not all the songs are very demanding of his voice, but when he gets into that upper register and is hitting those like falsetto notes, the crowd was eating that up, first of all, but he sounded really good. For me, like, the whole part of what makes that album or the leak really work is like the strangeness and the unfinished textures of the production and how his voice is one component in that, but it's also just these little spliced in moments of weird samples and things like that, that type of music is pretty hard to like translate in a live setting.
The recreation of imperfection, not simply the recreation of perfection, which is obviously like much more standardized and obvious.
I thought the band was really tight. The rhythm section in particular and the bass, the really like...
Shout out the family tree of Pino Palladino.
They sounded awesome. It gave me a sense of just how bassy a lot of those songs are. Like, that's not really a quality that's emphasized that much on the record, but the actual bass lines of a lot of these songs are really strong, and that came through live. But it's like there were moments when I felt like his voice and the everythingness on stage, it was swallowing him up a little bit. And I think in some ways that was by design, because I don't think he's someone who is to come out and sing a run a cappella and, you know, like stand there. But like, I think he needed that sound around him to feel comfortable enough to sing. I don't know if I was wishing for like a more stripped down version, because these songs have an excess about them.
Is there a song that you were surprised at how it was presented in that context? Like, didn't sound exactly like you thought, didn't align with your memory of the song?
Let me think about this for a second. I don't think that Jasmine translated that well live, which was kind of surprising to me. And the last three songs he played were Jasmine, BTS to You, and then Straight Outta Mumbai, which I think we both thought was a clear highlight of the set.
Should we listen to Straight Outta Mumbai?
Yeah.
Okay, let's get into Straight Outta Mumbai. Because my relationship with this song was maybe like neutral, like good, but not like, wow, this was a song that I thought was way better in this context. Do you feel that the band and J. Paul were trying to faithfully recreate the specifics of the versions of the songs on the leak? Or did they say, those are the building blocks, we are going to thicken up, massage, boost, amplify, put makeup on, and make new things out of this familiar subject matter?
I think it was a little torn between those two extremes. On the actual record, there are these moments where it's really loud and then the music cuts out and there's this like fun vocal sample or something, like there's a real like collage, like patchwork quality to the production on the songs. And there were moments when they tried to do that on stage. And it's one of those records where if you know the record by heart, you know all the words and you know all the little drops and stuff too. Like on a song like Genevieve, when they tried to recreate the glitches, they would get like applause from the crowd as though it was like a favorite lyric or something. I think Genevieve was the first song where that really, and he came out playing newer material, we should say too, like did not lead with
anything obvious.
The hits. No.
Let's listen to Genevieve, because I also agree that Genevieve was like the real transition point for the night. The thing that should be said about Genevieve, and also I think he played Good Time right before that, you really get the Prince-ness of the whole thing. These are R&B songs. These are funk songs. These are, in some cases, like light dub dance floor songs. But in that midpoint where the concert really shifted from like, hey, we're all just hanging out, it's cool vibes, cool, yeah, good night, hey, bro, yeah, nice, killing it, yeah. Like, we're transitioning from that to like, yo, that was Genevieve. And part of that is the Prince-ness of those moments, which is to say fusion, sensuality, cocksureness, rhythmic ambition. All that stuff all of a sudden went to overdrive, and then I think really stayed at a pretty high level for the rest of the night. But Genevieve, to me, really underscored how much J-Ball is paying attention to Prince when assembling songs.
Another philosophical question I want to sort of bring up. Yes, I know Prince at heart and like in some ways was this like shy, introverted person, but on stage, he was a total freak. How can you be in this lineage of Prince and making neo Minneapolis funk music and
not be a freak
on stage a little bit, and or just be standing there behind the sunglasses and stuff and not wanting to cultivate like this stage persona? I think that's the really interesting pop philosophical question about him. And I think there are elements of funk and soul and R&B and electronic music in all of the J-Paul experience, but at heart, I think they're pop songs. And I think he's a pop artist at the end of the day. I was thinking about this watching him and watching his endearingly stiff stage presence. To be a pop musician, is there like something else in the contract that we are asking for, especially out of a live performance? But he's always kind of obviously had this retreat from the spotlight. Can you be a pop artist, especially now one like standing on a stage? I think you can in just like releasing stuff and then going away. But like, is there something in the audience contract that we ask for a little more? We need something else.
Okay, but let me answer that question with a question. Was anybody in the audience at your show disappointed with what they got?
No. And that was what was also very unique. There was an exchange between the crowd and the performer. Like, I don't know that it was being explicitly received by him, but there was this sense of just like, we're so happy that you're here and that you're okay and you're going through with this thing that is clearly kind of hard for you, and that you've had a lot of issues with the spotlight and whatnot. Like, to be a J-Paul fan is also to, again, have this sort of strange, like, ethical care about his well-being that you don't necessarily have for, like, other artists that you're fans of or artists that have bought more into the machinery of the music industry. Like, there was really no stage banter, but he did kind of the prayer hands
right.
A few times. And then people were like sending that back. And I was moved by it. Like, there was just something about it of like the audience's support and really wanting to make it clear. They were like chanting Jay at one point. It was really like there was like a sweetness about it that felt kind of genuine, but also felt really rare at a concert of that kind.
It was a show where like, I feel like everybody who I saw and I, you know, was like, are you writing about this? You reviewing this? And I'd be like, yeah. Like, I feel like at almost any other show where you have this conversation, people be like, oh yeah, this is good. Or oh, yeah, I don't know, it's kind of mid. Like, you should really trash this. This was a show where I feel like everybody was like, well, it's great. Like, it's great he's here. It's great he's here. You know, like sort of like, watch what you write. Watch what you write. It's like K-pop-ish in a weird way. You know, I'm a big boy. I'm going to say what I think. But it is striking to have that kind of almost like a uniformity of acclaim even before he stepped on stage. It's like people knew they were there to have a night where they celebrated this individual and the way that this music made them feel 12 years ago. That's why they were there. And I think if it had been you on stage in sunglasses doing exactly what he did, people would have had exactly as good a time. That's sort of how I feel. And I might have had a better time if he was like, I'm just vibing with y'all. Like, we did it. Like, we did it. That's how I feel about it.
After he played Good Time, he said, like, I hope everyone's having a good time. And everyone cheered, you know. Not someone comfortable being on stage, if we haven't made that clear.
Before we go, here's a real question. Now that you've seen him, you've, like, closed this loop. We've lived this narrative for 12 years, and we've closed this loop. If there's no new music, like, we're still in the same state of play with J Paul, would you pay money to see another J Paul concert in, like, roughly the same kind of setting?
Probably not. Am I getting on the guest list, or
No, you're paying.
I'm paying.
I'm paying. Oh, you no, big time now. Big time. I'm sorry. We failed to mention Lindsay Zola is, first of all, absolutely hired in the New York Times, as I think we've mentioned, but writing The Amplifier, which you should subscribe to. Sorry. How did we not even get to that? Lindsay, how does one subscribe to The Amplifier?
That's a very good question. I feel like there is, like, a specific URL or something. It's for Time subscribers.
Yeah, sorry. It's for Time subscribers.
Well, so you should subscribe to the New York Times if you have not already.
Great sales pitch.
But assuming that you have, you should just search the newsletter page and sign up. And even if you're not a subscriber, you can get 4 weeks of it free if you sign up too.
Look at that.
Like, you have no excuse.
No excuse. Lindsay Zola is out here talking about workout music. It's like, we're only 2 months in. We're already at physical fitness. I can't even imagine where we're going to be 6 months from now or 12 months from now.
Yeah.
Lindsay, I appreciate you showing up like J Paul and not taking 10 years to do it. So thank you so much. We will be back in a minute with Gia Tolentino. Just want to have a good time. I get you to be it. I know you won't feel it. Just want to have a good time. Good. We are back for part two of the J Paul Sound Clash. Gia Tolentino is here. Gia, bienvenue.
It's been a while.
It has been a while. I was extremely excited to see you at the show.
Not surprised at all to see you at the show.
Yes. That is my burden to bear. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Everyone I saw at that show, I was like, of course. It was like everyone I've ever seen at a show in Brooklyn in the last 10 years was like 50% chance they were at that show.
I believe I said this on the prior segment too, but someone very young texted Joe about the crowd and said everyone there was like 29.
Like, bitch, what did you expect? Like, like, this shit came out in 2010. Like, what? Who do you think is going to be there? Like,
of course, yes. And also, as someone who's been 29 for about 15 years, I accept that. I embrace it and I accept it.
There were actually more Gen Zers there than I thought were going to be.
But I agree, but it also was literally like every person you've ever seen in New York was at 100%. That show. Like, they were there. A lot of mustaches, a lot of creative directors, a lot of associate creative directors, if I'm going to keep it.
That's what I'm saying. A lot of, like, late 30s crises, you know, projected and worked through via J Paul, you know?
Absolutely. And for all those people, I just want you to know, I worked through all my crises in my 20s. So I wish you a idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for you.
Debatable, but sure. Okay. So you texted me after the show and you said, okay, I'm proud of him. And I said, melty face emoji, shrug emoji, upside down smile emoji. I'm not his parent. He was fine. And then you said, but everyone clapped like we were. And I think this is the kind of real conundrum of this show, which is, was there any way to genuinely assess it on a musical, technical, formal level? Or was it 100% emotional and the music performance, the performance, quote unquote, was like essentially an afterthought?
I think there was, and I think you did, and I think that, you know, we probably were both thinking, okay, like, what would the show seem like if it was 2014 and people played shows like this all the time and it was, you know, someone, like, knocking a huge beat and, like, with a weird projection on the wall in a bar somewhere and, like, singing falsetto kind of R&B vocals over it. Like, back when that was, like, every show I saw for years.
Yeah.
For me, those lines were kind of running parallel the entire time. If the question is, like, could you judge it purely without the context? I mean, for me, absolutely not. I have projected way too much on J. Paul in the last 10 years, you know? For me, actually, I spent a lot of the show feeling like a nervous parent. Giri wrote a really good piece at Defector, I think, about it, where it was like, you know, it was real, like cheering your third grader on to a soccer field kind of vibe,
yeah.
You know, or like, you know, like our grandma's walking for the first time, you know, which to me, like I was like, how there was a weird, that weird condescending edge to the kindness and generosity. Right. That even I could feel in myself, like I was like, how can you both be like a messianic figure and also someone that we're like so proud for singing on key
or just showing up, like very simply standing on stage?
To me, the way I think about him is like kind of amply contains both. You know, I still think that leak was probably one of the most important incomplete collections of MP3 files that I transferred from laptop to laptop in my 20s. I think it would have been different if it wasn't his literal third time playing live in his life. It's so anomalous. You're never judging someone on 10 years of reputation on their third show.
Is that swaddling that the audience was doing, on some level, is that a disservice from the actual quality of the music? Which, to be fair, maybe never got to an A+ during the show. I mean, I think a lot of the records are A+.
His music definitionally sounds like some shit's going wrong, mm-hmm. kind of, mm-hmm. you know, like there's some songs that the keys never settle.
And it is a little condescending. It feels like to be like, oh, he did it. And that stresses me out.
He's having fun. Our sweet boy is having fun.
Like, is that not a little condescending and dismissive of the music?
I don't know if it's dismissive of the music, because I think some of the songs sounded bad, I thought, and some of them sounded way better than they did on that leak, right? Like the stuff that he was expanding, like I thought All Night, he did that as a duet, and it was gorgeous and full, like with Fabiana Palladino on it. And Chicks, is that the really princey one?
I mean, there's a couple really princey ones, yeah.
There's a lot of princey ones. It was pretty obvious what the show and his performance, the nerves the crowd had about his performance, like the way that thickened it in kind of a glorious way, and the way that thickened it in like a, yeah, the swaddly way. I was really glad for this because he stretched out some of those fragments that were like 55 seconds on the leak, and he made them full songs. I often thought his vocals sounded way better than they did on the album, because I was never sure like what his voice was actually like, because it's so processed, and with exactly that kind of production, you never know. And give us like a Frank Ocean, Miguel kind of, I found him to be much more fluid and agile as a vocalist than I was personally expecting. And maybe those expectations were condescending, but you, in the back of my head, you know, you wonder if that's one of the reasons you don't play a show for 10 years. You're a bedroom producer and, you know, maybe you don't want to be front and center with your vocals. You know, the question you're asking is sort of a question of like, has his whole career been a disservice to the music?
It's like backhanded acclaim. If I was on the receiving end of that, that might stress me out, and it might not make me feel, if I was getting revered simply for showing up rather than I nailed it. And I'm not saying he didn't nail it at points. I'm just saying the energy in that room was not, damn, this is the best and most accomplished music performance I've ever been to. Like, that might not reinforce or amplify the confidence that the mid-level confidence I had walking in.
I don't think he's getting the full swaddle. I think it's this combination of extremely high and extremely low expectations that I think exists at the same time, right? It is absolutely condescending. Every metaphor I have for it is condescending, you know? But it's like everyone is amazed that the wildlife cam is showing the birdie flying out of the nest. You know what I mean? Like, everyone is so amazed. But that's not going to last forever, you know? Like, you know what I mean? Like, presumably we can give him this for his first six shows.
I found that the triangulating that I had to do in the writing, like I could feel myself torn between, what was that? You can't really expect my guy to be really out here. You know, like it was like juggling 10 different what ifs all at the same time. And I think your piece also did a really elegant job of, I can't look at this strictly through the lens of like, this is a performance, it was it good or bad. And I feel like I even tried to say, if we went to any other show with that specific level of performance, we would be like, this is sus.
Yeah, I mean, except, right. I mean, we should shout out, like, look, Straight Out of Mumbai was truly amazing. Truly, really, really, like, a real highlight of a live experience in Brooklyn for the last couple of years for me, for sure. But yeah, you're absolutely right. it's kind of interesting that the thing I was comparing it to was not like seeing like a tier one artist crush it, but like seeing someone perform with their backing track at a bar in Greenpoint. You know what I mean? Like I was thinking of it in like,
yes, that's those a really terms, good, that's of. A really good way to put it. It's like the tension between like reviewing like a Dua Lipa record and some indie rock records. Like you don't expect the same things. And maybe that's the way we should be thinking about this. Like, obviously you don't expect him to have like a super, super crisp grand scale performance and visual effects and confidence, but I can't remember the last time I saw someone on a stage who seemed that uncomfortable. Like that is noteworthy in and of itself. It's noteworthy.
For me, it was very much giving an egg, a spaceship egg dropped him out, dropped him on the stage. And like,
wildlife,
he's trying to
cam,
deal.
Spaceship egg.
It is my hope that maybe the high expectations and the low expectations combine into whatever vibe of comfort is necessary for him to
keep putting records on.
Yeah, because I was like, damn, we've only gotten two Finnish songs ever. Like, come on. I think it was kind of lovely and I think appropriate for this weird parental vibe to happen right now. I don't think it'd be appropriate for anything beyond this summer. I think it's time to like really expect what we have always expected of him. No more demos. Like, no more demos, please. The thing that was most interesting to me about the show and the sort of Brooklyn creative director vibe of it all was like the level of kind of projection, personal projection that you could feel kind of ricocheting around the room was kind of amazing to me. And it's like those records came out at a time when everyone was trying to assess their own potential and how they would be in the world and what they were actually going to be able to do. Like, I thought everything that we were projecting on him, people were kind of like, people were clapping for parts of themselves, you know, like the like, am I ever going to be able to do the thing? And like, did I peak when I was 20? And did I, you know, am I ever going to feel that strongly? I think there was this quality to the music where we thought of it as this like empty vessel where all of our personal desires and whatever can live. And then there's a startling thing to be like, oh, he's been there the whole time.
Maybe my bad metaphor is, it did feel class reunion-y in the sense where you are surrounded by the people who you shared a very intense experience with, and you are there as your current self, but navigating how your current self is reconcilable with your old self.
It's processing, yeah. And
just like he was. We all were kind of in that same frame of mind. That's very real.
Yeah.
Apart from the two songs that came out in 2019, has J. Paul ever released a quote-unquote finished song?
No.
So the fact that those songs are released in the format that they are have been released in, which is like unfinished / demo, does that in and of itself constitute completion? Because for the vast majority of the universe, that is the only version that they know, and it is publicly available, it is widely shared, it's now on streaming services. So whatever ideas J. Paul had about what those demos might become becomes immaterial. It's kind of only matters that that song exists in that form and has imprinted on people like me and you in a very specific way. That's part one of the thought. Part two is, if those songs technically are complete, even though maybe he didn't feel that way, but they're technically complete because the cycle between music creator and the listener, that loop has been closed up. What was he trying to do at the concert? Was he trying to be faithful? And you touched on this a little bit, but did you get the sense that he wanted to be faithful to the versions that people felt comfortable with? Or was he trying to tell us, actually, this is what I had in mind, this is where I was going? What do you think?
So I don't think that they're complete. I mean, what you're saying about the loop between, you know, if that is the definition of a finished song, that the loop is closed, they are finished. They don't sound finished to me. Like my brain can't hear those songs and consider them finished. Like, I think that BTS to You and Jasmine are close to finished. And I think that something like Chicks, like the ones that are 55 seconds. And he had like a bunch of those other ones. I was remembering, like, didn't he have like a There's a Limit to Your Love flip? Like, that was really good. If the structure of the song is effectively finished, which I think that Straight Outta Mumbai, like Zion Wolf, like those seem like the finished version would just be better vocals and a better mix.
But what must it feel like for him to know in his mind that these songs are not finished, but everybody loves them? does it make him as a performer look in the, or as a music maker look in the mirror and be like, damn, am I wrong? Like, am I actually, is my vision for these songs actually the failed vision of these songs and the one that got released? Is this incomplete thing actually better?
Maybe. Get him on Popcast.
I know. I said that in the last segment, but Jay Paul, come on Popcast. Talk to us.
Also, like, give us the finished versions and let us decide, like, maybe 10 years from now we'll finally get them. But, like, I just really want to know which of those production effects are demo problems and which are intentional.
Also, like, what a hilarious potential inversion of the box set model, because the box set model is like, here's the Beatles album, but here's the 30 demos that preceded it.
Yeah.
What if the J. Paul box set is, here's the demos, and low-key, these are the finished versions, like,
look, here is one crisp, clean sound. Wow. You know, like, wow.
I bet that's all I want. I bet it wouldn't be as good. I truly bet it wouldn't be as good.
I know. I truly wouldn't be.
Okay. So, J. Paul 2024, what are you thinking? Album? Real tour? Nothing?
If I were to put money on this, I would guess EP towards the end of next year. And then who knows? Like, I was asking myself a lot, like, why is he doing this? Like, why is he doing that? Why the hell would he do it for the first time at Coachella? Like, why would you do that? Like, even in Knockdown, I was like, why wouldn't you have done this for the first time, like, in a small venue where everyone is there for you, you know, like, explicitly? And I felt like starting at Coachella is a wild decision. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. So I was trying to make sense of, like, why now? Obviously, it's a 10-year anniversary, but, like, really, why now?
I assume money. I'm going to say money.
Money is never a non-exigent reason. But I also think that there are probably easier ways for that man to make money that don't involve something that he's been clearly horrified to do for his whole career. You know what I mean?
Like Fear Factor J. Paul edition.
Yeah, like, it's like he could just produce more, you know what I mean? Like, it could really, like, just to do more with the Paul Institute or whatever. I would guess that he wouldn't have taken this ridiculous swing of coming out at Coachella for his literal first set ever if he wasn't trying to see if the next 10 years could hold a revision of the last 10. My projection is, like, you know, he was trying to see, like, it's not too late. Like, can I do this?
I think he's sitting on an album.
Already?
Yeah.
Do you know that?
No, God, I wish I knew any. I don't know anything.
Well, he can't not have material, that's for sure. I mean, like, I don't think he's not been making music for himself secretly. Like, there's no way he hasn't.
I think he's got finished, quote unquote, finished songs.
Damn, you think he's going to do it, like, surprise full drop?
Yeah.
When do you think he's going to do it? End of this year? Like, sort of like D'Angelo season?
Yeah, like summer, kind of fall, like, something like that. Like, yeah, I think it's coming.
I would love it if it dropped like December 1st.
Well, J. Paul, if you're listening, talk to me about it. Talk to Gia about it. You know, just talk to someone about it. Like, anyone, really. But we're here.
I think my expectations would just be very high. Like, I think they would be like when Blonde came out or whatever. Like, I think I'd expect and want and really need something spectacular. But I don't doubt that he could do it.
All right. Well, we will see where our emotional expectations truly are when J. Paul surprise drops the 37-track album that he's working on.
Yeah. We'll check back in. Yeah.
That is our show. Thank you to Gia. Thank you to Lindsay. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. We have stickers now. In addition to t-shirts, it's thepopcast.myshopify.com. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcastdiscord/podcastfacebook, and subscribe to Popcast. Anyway, you get your audio content. That is Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, yada, 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 yada. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Let's go out with a completed J. Paul song. This is Do You Love Her Now?